Everybody, welcome to another Blind Like Me after our little vacation. We had a nice time at Padre Island, and a lot of things happened, but anyway, we'll tell you more about those later. We're visiting with a fellow named John German from, where are you from, sir?
Elmira Heights, New York.
Elmira Heights, New York.
Southern part of the state.
The southern part of the state.
If you know where Corning is.
Yeah.
Okay. If you go from Corning and you go into this big flats and then you go a little bit further, you're going to hit Elmira Heights.
Elmira Heights, New York.
It's part of the Elmira complex. Elmira is lower, but the Heights is up in a hill.
And you've lived there all your life?
Yep.
This has always been your home?
Yep.
And you went, I think I talked to Tim about, he called me and told me that you had talked to him. And he said you went to, I think it's Batavia School, New York.
Batavia School for the Blind. I was up there from 51 to 65.
51 to 65. So what age are you, sir?
I'm 60. I'll be 61 August 10th.
So you're 60 years old, and you're, I guess, probably basically retired.
Yeah. Reason why I retired early was because of allergies. I worked for Eastern Metal, which is a road safety equipment company in Elmira.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure you've seen, nose cone or nose cone. Yeah, there are these cones on the streets when they repair the roads. They're like a rubberized cone. They sometimes stick flags into them.
Yeah.
You've probably seen the signs. Might say, dumping, no fire. They might say, no smoking, please. Or they give, there'll be dead-end signs. I've got one of those right here on my yard.
Or they'll just be strung along where the road is closed. There'll be a series of those cones.
Right, right.
I've seen those. Somebody I knew had a couple. In fact, I may have one. People like to steal those things, don't they?
Yeah, you got to watch it. You got to watch it.
Well, and that's what the company that you work for, that's what they manufactured?
Yep. Matter of fact, there goes the fire siren. They started the business back in 1947, and then they went and, by the time my mother started working for them in 52, and they used to be here in the Heights originally. They used to be on Grand Central Avenue,
uh-huh.
And then they moved over to Sullivan Street by 1967 in Elmira, and they've been there ever since.
And you worked for them for many years.
Yeah, I worked for 23 years.
23 years. What was your job there? What did they have you do?
Oh, I was a flag assembler. I worked in the shipping department. Flag assembler, sign packer. I did all the packing, a lot of the packing. Matter of fact, we had 1, 2, 3, 4, about 6 people.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes doing the same job.
Is that right?
Packing or I enjoyed it, but after a while, then all of a sudden I was getting terrible allergies, and from the dust and so forth there.
Well, were you the only blind person who was employed by these people, right?
No, we had up to 4 or 5 people that were blind. We had John Scarborough. We had Larry Holbert, who died in 1962. We had, I'm trying to think, we had 2 other people that were blind that worked there for a spell.
So they were actually pretty good about hiring blind people then, weren't they? That was pretty.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I used to bring my little, I used to use my little pocket Brailer now, which came out of London, England, Banks, out of Portland Street, London, and it was it's a little small Brailer you can use that there's no backspace on it. You can use it, and it'll you can slowly, if you do it just right, and the braille is going to be a little bit smaller, a little bit closer together. You got to get used to it, but it will work. And I used to bring that in the Easter Mount once in a while and get names down.
Let's get back to your early childhood. You were born totally blind, sir?
I was born with cerebral palsy. 1944, August 10th, 1944. That's Herbert Hoover's birthday. And here in Elmira, in Arnagin Hospital, I had cerebral palsy. And for a while, about 2 years after, by the time I was 2 years old, they were afraid that I might have polio, because there was a polio epidemic at the time. And they found out, no, I had cerebral palsy, which affected my sight. I'm what we call legally blind. I can see some print. I have one of these CCTVs in front of me right now, which I can use. Yeah.
So you do have some. You still have some sight.
Oh yeah.
Oh well, good. I didn't realize. I think you had told me about your CCTV, but I didn't realize that. But you were blind enough that when you were a little child, they decided to send you to the blind school, to the school for the blind.
Right. Well, they tried me. First of all, it was our school over here on Madison Avenue, and I know everything's all broke loose over there. And I thought, oh God. And so they sent me up to the blind school in Batavia. At first, I was a little afraid it might be a little bit too dangerous, but I got used to it, and Tim started going up there the year after I started.
Yeah, I don't think they like for us to call them blind schools. They want like for us to call them schools for the blind. I think
they were called blue schools for the blind. Matter of fact, the New York State School for the Blind had a poem written about in the 1880s called the school. Asylum.
The asylum for the blind. Yes.
Yeah, one time.
Yeah, that's terrible. You know, one time in Texas, they had the deaf and the blind schools together.
Yeah, we had a school for the deaf in Rochester and a school for the blind in Batavia.
Yeah. So,
and now that school in Batavia is no longer a blind school. It's now, I call them Krankenhauses, okay? That's a German word for hospitals, for kids who are, well, they're still blind, but they're really multiple handicaps.
Yeah, because most children that are just blind or just have a vision problem now go to...
They go to public schools.
Mainstream them.
Yep, they mainstream.
Which is good, I suppose.
Well, I don't know. There was a big hullabaloo by the time they were doing that. There was a big hullabaloo. Public schools did not want to deal with it at first, and they were fighting New York State. It was happening all over the United States, believe it or not. This actually happened. And, matter of fact, we have in, you know where Wichita, Kansas is?
I do.
Okay, there's a place there out there. At one time, it was called the Institute of Logopedics. Later, it became HeartSpring. Now, us barbershoppers used to sing, we sing it, they shall speak. And now, they don't sing it anymore because they got so much money. They get more money, Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy combined now. And so we do it just for, barbershoppers do it for putting music back into the schools. And then instead of singing, we sing and they shall speak, they teach the children to sing.
But now, they started you as a child at Batavia learning Braille and learning the things and teaching you. teaching you to, I guess you already knew how to dress yourself and feed yourself and all those kind of things, all right, already?
Oh, yeah. I had to, in those days, of course, they had slate stylus.
Yeah.
And then they had, by the time I got there, they were not using tight slates anymore. They were using cube slates.
I don't know the difference in the cube.
Okay, a tight slate for mathematics were like a pegboard. You slid these pegs, and on top of the pegs were like, you could feel they were like braille, like it might have a 6 or 4 or an 8 or a 0, all depending how you looked at it. And then on the opposite side might have either 5
okay.
or 9, all right, an E or an I.
Okay.
And then on the, and then some of the pegs might show a 7 on one side and maybe a 2 on the other side.
So if you turned them over, they showed something different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Then when they got the cube slates, by the way, the one, some of them had a 1, and then some also had like a, might be a minus sign or a plus sign, all depending on what you had on the opposite end, but they were pegged, they were about like an inch long.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like putting pegs in the pegboard. Then when they went to cube slates, like a little about size of a, you know, your little miniature ice cube trays?
Yeah.
Plastic?
Yes, sir.
If you took those, you could make use those for cubes. You had, plastic cubes. I got two cube slates. I got one of the little bit larger cubes, plastic cubes, and one a little bit smaller. And the smaller have a blank face on one side. It's a six-sided cube, and they have a 1, they have a 2, or 3, that could 2 or 3, or out, you know, one side could be a 4, 6, 8, 0, another one could be 5 or 9, and then the 7 on one side. And you had to, but it was slow going mathematics. I was terrible at math. Matter of fact, a lot of us kids were. A lot of us kids.
We had a thing in Texas we called a number frame where we put type. They were lead type, and we put them in little holes, and you could set up a problem. Ones, twos, threes, fours, and fives. And
how long were the pegs that went in there?
They were probably a quarter of an inch long. And fit in a little hole, a little square hole, and you could set up a problem. I'd like to have one now. I believe they were called the Texas Slate. That's how we did math. That's how they.
Yeah,
that's
well,
how
they, there were several versions of that. There were several. As a matter of fact, at New York State Schools of the Blind, as a matter of fact, the early days, I want to go back. Back in the 1920s,
or
earlier, they weren't using the standard Braille we know today. They were using what was called New York Point Braille, which is like little G's. And they had a different way of doing Braille at that time. And we even had one teacher, Mr. Milligan, refused to change over, and he kept all of his... New York Point Braille that he had when he graduated in 1910, he kept it, and he wouldn't change after.
New York Point Braille. Now, do you know a lot about? Do you know how that? I've never heard of that.
Okay, New York Point would be like, you know what? You know in Braille, you know what G's look like? A letter G.
Yes, sir.
Or a number 7. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Now, the New York Point Braille would be just like writing up G's, except they were in a different pattern. And it would be like if I wanted to say hello, it might look like for the H, it might show a G and maybe part of a G. After that, it might be for an L. I'm not sure just exactly, but they were in the pattern. Instead of having 6 side cells, they were just 4. And the combination was a little bit different, and they were spread a little bit further apart, too.
Well, we might try to do some research one of these days on New York Point Braille, because I guess I've heard about it, but I don't really know anything about it.
Yeah, Muriel Hammond had a couple things that were New York Point, and that wound up in the archives. We have an archives.
I bet we can find somebody who knows or something about it.
New York Point, it was, we had, at that time, in the turn of the century, we had the Wait Point, W-A-I-T Point, a fellow who came out of where he started with New York Point. Then he started his own. And then it was the Cutter Point, C-U-T-T-E-R Point. That was mainly for music. But there was Point Braille for music, believe it or not. Yeah.
New York Point
was...
I'll tell you what, let's do them
today.
Let's take a break, and then we'll try to move you into high school and see how you did there and what you decided to do after. Our guest is John German. Our show is called Blind Like Me. We'll be back in just a second. Hang on.
Made a lot of new friends on the Blind Like Me list that I'll never forget.
Well, them crazy people on that Blind Like Me list just talk about the silliest thing.
To join the Blind Like Me list, send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
Okay, I love being on the Blind Like Me list because I'm the moderator and I get to delete people if I want to.
If you enjoy chatting with other blind folks, come join us on the Blind Like Me list. Send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. Blind Sites. Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sites, here's Tim Cummings.
Quite often on the Blind Handyman Show, one of the places that's discussed is Home Depot. Our own Linda Justice works for Home Depot in their customer service department, and it's always brought up as a good place to buy tools. Well, I decided to finally check out Home Depot's website to evaluate it in terms of accessibility. The site is pretty accessible. The easiest way to access the site is to go to the main page, which is at www.homedepot.com, and look for the edit box close to the top of the page, which says search for an item. And you can type in a keyword or an item that you're looking for. I was looking for some caulk, and I typed in the word caulk, and then hit enter on the search button, and was brought up a whole bunch of listings for that particular item. And the rest of the site, once you've found what you're looking for, is very accessible in terms of buying the item that you want and looking at the data on the item and so on and so forth. I would give it an accessibility rating of a 7. For Blind Sites, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sites.
Back with more Blind Like Me. I'm Phil Parr. John German is our guest from what did you say, Elmira, New York?
Elmira Heights. Think of Shaker Heights, Cleveland Heights, Brooklyn Heights.
Elmira Heights.
Yeah. Heights means that you're up on a little bit higher level than the normal area.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where that idea comes from.
So Elmira Heights, New York.
Yeah. Now, as a matter of fact, you've heard people say, we have nothing to hit but the heights. Well, that's what they're referring to. That's where that
happened. I've heard that old song, I suppose. I guess
yeah.
I've heard that old song. What were you interested in when as a child? What sorts of things were you?
I was into sports, some sports. We had baseball when we played baseball, we didn't use a regular baseball. We used volleyball. You know what they look like?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay, a volleyball, it would be like a basketball, the size of a basketball, but, you know, has a bladder in it.
Yeah.
And you had to be careful. If you hit them real hard with a bat, they'll break, okay?
Uh-huh.
Because I knew a kid that did that one day. His name was Leonard Gilbert, and he hit it just right. I was in the playground, and I just, boom, oh, it was loud. I said, geez, what the hell was that? All of a sudden, he comes by, and he says, John, you know what? You know that big boom? I said, yeah. I said, what the hell was that? He says, I just broke a volleyball. Oh, Jesus. Oh, man. I bet you could have heard that all over campus. I bet you could have heard it over to the girls' dorm, too.
Now, how did you all play baseball? Did you roll it down to, you had a pitcher and a batter, and
right. We had a pitcher. We used to use the athletic field that we had. We had a regular bat, volleyball, and then what the pitcher would do, he would, instead of, you know how you throw a baseball, you pitch it and, like, they say, oh, like 80 or 90 miles an hour, which I don't think that's really true.
Yeah.
But it would sort of more or less bounce the ball to you, and then you would just swing it with, hit it with a baseball bat, okay?
Okay.
And it would be that much easier so that when the ball would bound, and then you could just hit it. And we had fun doing it, and it was enjoyable. Matter of fact, we had a couple incidents. Back around 52, 53, they were playing ball in the athletic field, and somebody hit it, went over the fence, they got a home run, but the ball we had houses on State Street, hit one of the houses, broke a window.
Really, from a blind guy hitting a ball?
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
A guy hitting a ball. And then we had another case after my friend Vinny Tagliarino left school in 54. This happened around 55, 56, and we had a fellow that, he again hit the ball, went over, it bounded off one of the houses in State Street, and bounded back over, and Mr. Goldberg, our gym teacher, caught it. He goes, it was a riot.
So it went.
We had one case when Mr. Paradise was a gym teacher after about 1958, 59, or 60. He wore the Anderson, hit it, but he hit it the wrong way. It went over the fence and hit the gym window and broke a window. And Mr. Paradise says, oh, boy, somebody's got to go after that. And the word went out into the gym, caught the ball, got over the ball and tossed out the broken window and over to the athletic field. Mr. Paradise caught it. And
now, but you had some sight, so you could see the ball coming to
you.
Yeah,
I could see the ball. I still can see the ball.
But there were blind kids that couldn't, of course.
No, the blind kids that couldn't. Tim Handel, Earl Bugby, Ed Cooney, I'm trying to think of Ken Meyer, could not. If a ball was coming, Mr. Paradise would say, swing. Or sometimes Bob Mosier would help on, he would sound swing. Or I'm trying to think of also Victor Burgoyne would help out. He would say, swing. And when you swing at a volleyball, it's different from hitting a regular baseball.
Oh, bigger. Yes, a whole lot. Yeah.
And but
you say they kind of bounced the ball toward you, so you could kind of hear the ball a little bit.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not like deep ball. Deep ball is a little bit, if you hit one of those, you know.
Yeah,
it wouldn't last all that long, you know.
That's what I was going to say. The beep ball, you can hear that ball has a bell or something in it, and then you can hear it.
Wilbur Webb was part of that, used to be part of a beep ball league. I'm trying to think who else. I want to say Jack Green. And these are kids that graduated from my school in 54. And I'm trying to think of who. The deep ball, they got started with that after I had left school in 65.
Well, you had a pretty good time, sounds like, to me there at the school for the blind.
Oh, yeah. We had our ups and downs. I got school recordings.
You have recordings from the old school for the blind?
Oh, yeah. I got some orchestra recordings. I was part of the orchestra. I have candlelight service that I always took part in Batavia. Those were a little bit different from a normal candlelight service.
Now, what did you play in the orchestra? What instrument?
I played French horn.
French horn. And now, these recordings that you have, how did you record those?
Those were done. Mr. Monaghan, who was in the music department, would record. He had a homemade, it was one of those record cut, REK-O-KUT, disc recorder at that time. And by the time we hit the 50s, he was using what they call I want to say Voice of Music tape recorder. In those days they were not stereo. They didn't have stereo until about you get 59 or 60. But he still continued with the mono.
So he had a VM tape recorder.
Yep.
And they were pretty popular brand back then, the Voice of VM.
Yeah, in those days, we were lucky to have something that we could have. I got one candlelight service was sort of breached because parts of the song, some of the songs are not on there. I got all of 61 and 62, most of 64 and most of 67 all on cassette tape now. They originally were on reel-to-reel tape, and again, mono, and I transferred them, now I've mounted them onto a CD, into CDs.
Yeah,
and
that's what I was going to say, you put them on CD. So you played
I ran it through a computer.
You played the French horn in high school.
Yeah.
And graduated from the Batavia school there. In 65.
And then I started working for Eastern Metal in 65.
So you went immediately to work for this Eastern Metal company that made traffic cones.
Yeah, they made other things besides the traffic cones. They made the signs, you know, all the signs on the street signs. They made, it's called Eastern Metal's of Elmira, and now it's marked USA Signs. Their main focus was on signs, okay? But they did other work besides making signs.
Okay.
Matter of fact, my grandfather made a special contraption for them that had, like, glass beads with them in regards to making signs. He made that way back in 52. And, of course, my grandfather died in 74.
Now, your grandfather made, invented or created some piece of equipment for this company?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, was that because you worked there, or just
no,
worked there?
Well, he made it. My mother had just started working there, and he was making it. Actually, he started working on it even a little bit before she started working there. And by the time she started working there, then he had it all done and gave it to Jack Knapp, who owned the company. He started him and Burley Names. Both are gone, by the way. Both that one died in his 90s, and the other died just about 2 or 3 years ago in his late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all started. They had another company called Hubbles. I don't know if Hubbles is still going or not. That was their rival company.
But you retired from this company after 20 years? How many years?
23 years. I retired in 1988.
In 1988. And
my mother was in poor health.
Uh-huh.
At the time, she retired in 1984.
Uh-huh. And you never married?
No. I've been trying to find somebody, but I've never been able to find anybody so far.
Never have found a wife, huh?
No.
Well, maybe you're better off. I don't know.
I don't know. That's a rough.
Tim tells me that you are quite an expert on wind-up Victrolas, that you know a lot about them and about...
Yeah, right. Now, when we say wind up, we're talking back to the time of Caruso, right?
Yeah.
We're talking the Victrola, the disc machines, and the cylinder ones. I like the cylinder ones. And we're talking back from 1890s on up to about the last wind-up cylinder machine issued roughly around 1915, 1916, around there.
Then they stopped making cylinder machines then.
Yeah,
then
they
stopped
making cylinder machines. They were still making the cylinders, though. But you know what they were doing? They were taking diamond discs and mounting them onto cylinders. And they would, this was because they had a terrible fire. And now they tell me December 1914, and I'm still looking further into it just to see officially when the fire did occur, so I know when did they stop making the cylinders that were pure cylinder, and then when they went into doing diamond discs onto cylinders. I'm looking into that. Find the official date for that.
Now, I've never seen a cylinder, so I wanted to just ask you some questions about one. They are just a long, round object. Give us a physical description.
Okay, picture, if you will, a drinking glass.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, not like a mug, but a drinking glass, okay?
Yeah, just a straight drinking glass.
Okay, these would be somewhat tapered. Okay, on the inside would be tapered so that the cylinder that would fit onto a mandrel that was tapered so that the big end would be to the left and the narrow end at the right. So you fit it onto the machine, and then you had a lead screw, and you had your arm, or if you want to call it, would be like a short contraction. It would fit from a rod beyond the lead screw, well, it'd be towards the mandrel in the middle. They'd go left to right, and then you would put your cylinder, your needle, would be on a contraction. It would be almost a square and round. They had I'm trying to think of it. I assume you never saw a wind-up machine.
I have a wind-up Victrola that plays 78 records, but I've never seen the cylinders, no.
Okay, you know the part that can come off that has the needle on it?
Sure, the arm yes.
If you took one of those and had it, instead of having a needle that you screwed in, and we'll say you put a contraction, well, like a shank, you know, like a flat thing with a needle on that, and mounted it, instead of being into that part where it goes screwed it in, and you put it onto the part that felt like a drum, and then let it sort of pivot and dangle, and then have a rod going in from the drum over to the needle, then you would have the type that you would have for the cylinder.
Now, it would lay on the cylinder, and the cylinder would turn.
And the cylinder would turn.
And this thing would move along the cylinder. It would have
it
to
would
have...
move along the cylinder, but it had to have the lead screw guiding it, okay? And you know how when you play a 78, you don't have anything to guide it. It just does it by itself.
The grooves guide it, yes.
Okay, so...
Yeah.
So the cylinder machines, you have to have a lead screw in it.
And this screw...
The recording machines that they used in the 30s and 40s and 50s, Mr. Mahogany, he had a lead screw on his that would guide it while it was cutting the record for the disc.
Actually, I had one that was a Wilcox Gay that you pulled up the back of the arm, and it engaged something underneath there, touched a long screw, and this screw would guide the arm. You're right. It would these threads of the screw would move the arm along the record as you were cutting.
Yeah, that's the way this worked.
Okay, and that's the way the cylinder played. It had a lead screw.
I was telling the machines were that way.
It had a lead screw that kept that arm in place.
Yep.
and moved it along the cylinder. Now, what held the cylinder on the spindle?
Okay, the cylinder, because they were both tapered, and it went in, I go just so far. Now, majority of the cylinders, when they say cylinders, they were wax. Okay, you had to be careful, they break.
Yeah.
And although we had some indestructible cylinders and celluloid blue ambrels that Edison put out.
The Blind Handyman Show is blind people have as many plumbing problems and household repairs to do as sighted people do, but we can't do them exactly the same way sighted people do, so we need some input from other blind people to find out how they do household repairs, so we formed this Blind Handyman, and we got a list going. And as far as Blind Like Me is concerned, we want to use it as an educational tool. As I remember being a young adult, a young person, and thinking, well, how am I going to, I want a nice house and as kids and a good job, but how am I going to do that? And I had just had no idea. And I think the Blind Like Me Show demonstrates the fact that it can be done even if you are blind. That's not a handicap. It can be done.
If you would like to be a guest on either show, or you can suggest someone as a guest, email us at blindhandyman@hotmail.com or blindlikeme@txucom.net.
Well, so far, it's been a labor of love.
Do you know about the Blind Handyman List, sir?
The thing I like the best about the Blind Handyman List, great place to exchange information and gather ideas on anything to do with being a handyman around the house.
I found out how to fix my garbage disposal on the Handyman List. And it works.
If you'd like to join the Blind Handyman List, send a blank email to blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
The thing I like about the Blind Handyman List, I'm the moderator, and I can delete you if I want to. So don't get out of line. Stay on topic.
That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
Destructible cylinders were made a little bit before the Edison did, and that they were used, it came out of Albany, and then there was the Everlasting type that came out of Cleveland, Ohio. And those cylinders, I got a few of those. The ones that were from Albany have like metal rings in there to hold the core in tight, and those are, well, they say, oh, they're brass, and they're not brass, because I tested it with a magnet, and they were not brass.
Now, so there was no standard. There were really several different kinds of them.
There was the jumbo cylinder, much bigger than, about, you could fit it over your arm like a bracelet. If you jiggled it hard enough, they'd break. They were wax.
But the process of playing was the same, in that this cylinder had a groove that needle or stylus followed, and the lead screw kept it, kept the cylinder, and of course you had the grooves needed to be cleaned.
Yep.
So the principle was exactly the same as a record or a phonograph.
Yep. The only difference is that the cylinders and the diamond disc were hill and dale. They were going up and down. If you understand stereo, stereo is up and down and sideways, like your standard 78 your LPs were. Okay, that in other words, up and down and invert, and then going side to side is stereo. But diamond discs were always up and down. Cylinders were up and down. Pepe records, the same idea, were up and down. They took a strange needle. They took a needle with a little ball that rotated. I got a few of those.
But do you have a cylinder machine that you...
Yep, I got three of them.
To play cylinders on.
They play cylinders. I got the Edison Gem that plays 2 minutes, and then I got two that play 2 minute and 4 minute.
And you have cylinders that you could play on these machines.
I got about 500.
500 cylinders.
Yep.
My heavens. And three machines to play them with.
Yep.
Well, that's pretty amazing. Where would a guy get a cylinder machine? Where did you get these machines?
Okay. Oh, in auctions. I bought my Edison Gem in an auctionary. Well, in a flea market over here in Orchards one time. My mother was still alive, and I picked that up. And then one of them I got up in Hammondsport, New York, and the guy was selling one. That was 2 and 4, and I had to get some repairs. In those days, I used to go to Deansville, New York, and get them repaired. Now I have to go to Victor Hall Repair Service in Vermont to get them repaired. Tim may have told you about that, Marion Zadick, she may have mentioned it. She mentions it on her radio show on Saturday night on shortwave, 74.15 WBCQ. It's called Marion's Attic.
All right. Anyway, these machines are worth a good bit of money,
matter of fact, some go up about almost $3,000 now.
And these cylinders their sound comes out a horn like the old wind up
would sit on top, and then later the last machines ever made didn't have a horn on top; they had the horn in front, just like your Victrola record players.
Now, but this was all physical. There was no real electronics. There was no amplifier.
No. However, they did make some cylinders. Well, by the time they quit making the cylinders, they quit making the diamond discs. By 1929, a lot of people say, "Oh, the stock market crash put an end to that." No, that wasn't the case. The actual case was by this time everybody was going to Standard Records, and then so they went. Edison went from the diamond disc over to the needle type. In those days, they were called electric needle type, but they did have some diamond discs that were electrically recorded, but they didn't have any machine that you could, electrical machine that you could play them on, my understanding, but they did. I have a few of those that were done electric.
But I'm saying this is all physical, so there is no way to tie, nowadays if we want to dump something, a cassette or something to CD, we just take the output of the cassette machine and feed it into the computer or feed it into our CD recorder. You couldn't do that with this player. You'd have to put a microphone in front of the horn, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you'd have to put a microphone. That's what Marion Webster does, but when she does diamond discs, you're hearing a loud sound in there before it plays, and I'm trying to figure out, I can do it just by using a record player and disconnecting, not the Tat Red type, but with the standard stereo, what you had before the Red Tat Red, and unplug one of the lugs, for the for the stereo, and just so that only the Hill and Dale portion plays. If you play a diamond disc on it, really nice and clear. Really nice and clear. And it's too bad that you can't make it sound good quality.
But you can.
But it can't. Can be done.
I'm saying you can, you know how to do this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've done this couple of times. I'm in the process of taking a record player so I can use it especially for that. I've got to look at, got to look into the pattern, the way it's made. As a matter of fact, I got two that are of the belt-driven record players.
And those, those belt-driven turntables?
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm going to change that, the motor, and make the, I got to make the motor itself, the part that turns around, that part there, if I put a thing, an adapter onto that part, that spindle that moves around, make it so that it'll make the turntable go faster, then I'm going to be able to see if I can make it. Especially for 78 and especially for diamond disc.
Yeah, because you want it to play 78s, don't you?
Yeah. Only for 78.
Well, of course, there is, and I guess you know about, and we talked about a fellow that was kind of instrumental in inventing this. You know there is a laser turntable that plays.
Yeah, I know the laser.
It's about $10,000, I think.
Yeah, a little bit more than that now.
Well,
I was surprised when I found out what they are. But the laser, there again, you got to be kind of careful of what you're doing. Because I knew there was a guy here in Elmira at one time. He had one. I don't know where he purchased it at the time. That was about like 7 or 8 years ago. Maybe it was even more than that. But the laser, they started out with a laser somewhere in the 80s, maybe late 70s, early 80s. And then they, I think the reason why they're so expensive is the laser part for it. And then your CD players are that. That's a laser.
Now what?
Your CD.
Oh yeah,
your CD. Compact disc player.
Well, sure. Yeah.
That's a laser.
Well, yes, it is.
That's a form of a laser.
But it's there's no reason these turntables should be that expensive except that nobody wants one.
Yeah, nobody would.
I mean, they
would buy. I myself wouldn't want to buy one like that. Not for. Records for that expensive. I can do much better. Matter of fact, you go out into Oregon, okay? There's a place that's called tinfoil.com. All right? Now, this place will go, he plays cylinders, and I got several of the CDs. I got about 15 of the CDs that he had done. This Glenn Sage was doing it. And he uses, and he's got cylinders on these CDs, and it was done through I guess he's got a couple cylinder machines, and he's got a microphone into the horn. I can't remember just exactly how he worked it, and then it's going through this computer, and he's doing this CD through the computer. And
but he'll take your cylinder and put it on CD for you.
He can do that.
Yeah.
There's another guy. There's a thing that's called, now what did Marianne Webster call it? No. And probably put 78s on CD that way.
Yeah.
And rush out, get rid of the scratchy sounds. Matter of fact, you can do it yourself through the computer, if you have Roxio, and I'm still working in figuring out how to do mine.
Well, there are many, many programs that will take that supposedly take pops and clicks things.
How did we get into computers in the first place?
We've got some people who are pretty much experts on that we've done some interviewing with. Now, let's get away from cylinders. Do you have some actual old wind-up Victrolas, as we used to call them?
Yeah. I got two suitcase models. I got a desktop Victor machine, Victrola.
Uh-huh.
And then I got three Edison machines. I don't have a diamond disc player as of now. I almost bought one once, but it was one of those four-model jobs, and it had it was a big, great big thing that this lady had, and I got thinking, I don't know if I could handle that kind of a size, because I knew they had smaller ones. And
uh-huh.
So I went into Deansboro, and he says, yeah, but I'm out of them right now. And they were And, of course, Deansboro, which was up by in the south side of Utica, about 12 miles out of Utica, they closed that now. They used to have everything from music boxes to, it was called Deansboro Musical Museum, and that's closed now.
So that's not available anymore?
No. That place is, I used to take my sewing machines up there to get repaired. I used to take my, I used to buy records up there. I used to go about every year, go up there and get supplies and so forth.
Now, but there are still places that will work on your wind-up Victrolas or your things like that.
Oh, yes. There's Victrola Repair Service. That's St. Johnsbury, Vermont. I can give you a phone number for them. That's 1-800-239-4188.
You have that committed to memory, do you?
Yeah. Well, she advertises it on her Marion's Attic program on Saturday night. Then there's the Antique Phonograph Supply Company over here in Danvers, West Davenport, New York. I think it's Davenport, New York, and. They're a little more expensive. I'd have to look up the address for that one.
Okay, well, we're not concerned with that.
That's a little more expensive, but they do repair those.
But you can still buy needles, and you can still buy
the needles for these record players. Now, best place right there is Victor Repair Service in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. And I asked them, where do you get the needles? It's from the same company. I thought, oh, my God, I didn't know the company was still in existence. I forgot where they said the company.
Well, of course, the needle would just be a thick piece of wire. I mean, it's just a
piece of steel, and they wear out.
They do wear out. I remember as a kid, we had a record player that had two little cups up in front of it, one on the left and one on the right, and one was for new needles and one was for old needles.
Old needles, yeah.
So you'd get a new needle.
I got one better play that way.
Do you have one of those?
Yeah. I got a. It's a Symphonia. That is that way.
And how did
I got a Sears that was has only one cup.
How did you get interested in these old records and old music and old?
Oh God! Well, back when my grandparents had records. My mother, the only one passed on to my mother and my uncle. And then I took over after in the 50s, and I was interested in the pattern and what was used for electric and for acoustical recordings. Matter of fact, the first electrical records that were made were basically around April or May of 1925.
And that was the first electrical records that were made?
Yep. Victor, a good example of that is 19648 Collegian by Fred Waring's Pennsylvanians.
And they actually had tube-type amplifiers and microphones, and they recorded it electronically?
Yep. And you can hear a little bit of there from the microphone. You can hear very faint sound of that. Matter of fact, I got another one, 1925, Whitey Kaufman's orchestra doing Paddling Mandolin Home. You need a little more loud in the background from the microphone.
Paddling Mandolin Home.
Paddling Mandolin Home. Oh, yes, I'm paddling Mandolin Home.
I remember the song, Paddling Mandolin Home. I've thought about some of it.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Now, how many 78s do you have?
I only got about 3,000 or 4,000 or more. I got about...
There's a lot of difference in 3,000 and 4,000.
Yeah. I got about that much, about 4,000.
Do you have them all... Do you have them all cataloged? Do you have them all?
Yeah, I'm still in the process of getting them straightened out. I got about, I got my cousin Raymond's 70s, too. Most of his stuff was late 40s, early 50s. And most of that stuff that was transferred to 45, a lot of that stuff was made by when you get 1949 and 50, they had 78s and they had 45s.
Well, yeah, I remember when you could buy, when you went to a record store and they asked you, you want that on 78 or 45? You know,
yeah.
you could buy songs on either one. If you, of course, a lot of people didn't have record players that played 45s.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember?
The last 78s ever made were roughly around 1958.
Do you remember RCA made at one time a little changer? It was just a little square box with a turntable on top and a very light tone arm, and it only played 45s.
Yep.
It was just a little square thing.
Yeah, square box. They made, and the speaker in the front, well, they made the one that you could attach to like a radio or something, have it play through your radio.
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about. This had no amplifier.
It had no amplifier. You had attached it to a radio. I had one of those. Then light tone arm. After a while, though, the arm would, or the tubes in it would go. And it was awful hard to find tubes. Now, I wish I still had that, because now I was talking to somebody about 3 years ago. And he says, you know, there's a place where you could get those repaired. And I said, oh, really? I want to say it was in Minnesota, but I'm not sure.
But, well, yeah, tubes are accessible now. Tubes are pretty easy to find nowadays. You can places now that we have the internet. There's several places you can buy tubes, but you don't have one of those little square RCA boxes.
No, not now. I had the one with the speaker, and I had the one that you attached to the radio. Actually, I like the one that was attached to the radio.
I never saw the one with the speaker. Then I had a thing that RCA also made called a slide-o-matic.
Okay, the slide-o-matic, you slid the record in, and then you had a thing you pressed, and the arm would go over onto the record. Tim Endel had one of those.
Yeah, when you put the record in, it would play. Once you slid the record in, it would automatically play the record.
It automatically played the record.
Then he would pick the arm up, and then the record would come popping back out to you.
Yeah, and that was RCA Victor also.
Slide-o-matic, and then
Slide-o-matic.
But this little RCA, this little square changer would hold a whole stack. It would hold like a dozen 45s,
and it would hold up to 12 records. It would play up to 12.
It would
records. Drop
it, and it would play one, then it would pick the arm up, and then it would drop another one and set the arm down. And if they were adjusted right, you could hear 12.
And later, they made the LPs that way.
You could hear 12 continuous records.
Yep.
Uninterrupted music. Wasn't that great?
Oh, yeah. And those record players were really handy to have. Tim Man that had a slide-o-matic. I never had a slide-o-matic, but he did. We had to watch it because sometimes a 45 wouldn't quite fit in there because we had to file. Tim Handel and I had to file a record down so it would play in his slide-o-matic.
So you could put it in his slide-o-matic.
Yep.
All right, well, John German, we've killed an hour talking about...
Yeah, I just heard the clock just strike 11.
Talking about something. I don't know what we've talked about, but we've killed about an hour talking about old record players and old slide-o-matics and 78s and cylinders. And we appreciate you coming and being on the show, and good luck. And if anybody wants to get a hold of you, do you have an email address or a phone number or something you want?
I'm at ispwest.com. They can contact me also by phone, 607-734-5029.